This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Welcome to the Billy Wilder Theater. I'm Claudia Bester. I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the Hammer Museum. And I'm very pleased to welcome you to tonight's talk on Teaching Artists and Arts Education by Nick Rabkin. Tonight's talk was organized by my wonderful colleagues in the UCLA School of the Arts and Architecture, Associate Dean Barbara Drucker and Julia Carnahan of the Arts Education Program. We're always very pleased when we have a chance to collaborate with them, and especially on a topic of such importance to all of us, the future of arts education and the role of teaching artists in education. We are delighted and honored to have the head of the UCLA School of the Arts and Architecture with us tonight, and he's going to introduce our guest speaker. Please join me in welcoming Dean Chris Waterman.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Billy Wilder Theater, the fabulous raspberry sherbet-colored sherbet, as I used to say growing up. Billy Wilder Theater and to the UCLA Arts Distinguished Lecture Series. This series is made possible through the generous support of the Maxwell H. Gluck Foundation, the University of California Institute for Research in the Arts, in collaboration with VAPA, UCLA's Visual and Performing Arts Education Program, and our host tonight, the Hammer Museum. The VAPA program, founded in 2010, has evolved out of a long history of community engagement on the part of faculty and students in the UCLA School of the Arts and Architecture. Under the leadership of Associate Dean Barbara Drucker, the gorgeous Barbara Drucker, under her leadership, and she is the former chair of our fabulous Department of Art, I should mention, for those of you who don't know that, and an artist herself. Artists, educators, students, and researchers are working to address the critical need for sustained access to arts education in our K-12 schools and beyond. Tonight, this is a very easy crowd. I like this. Thank you. How would I know? Tonight, we are delighted to provide the opportunity to hear from one of the leading thinkers in the field of arts education, Nick Rabkin. Nick's career in the arts began in 1980, producing new works for the stage as executive director of Chicago's Organic Theater Company. He served as deputy commissioner of cultural affairs for the city of Chicago under mayors Harold Washington and Richard M. Daley, as senior program officer for the arts and culture at the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and as director of the Center for Arts Policy at Columbia College in Chicago. In his continuing role as senior research scientist at the National Opinion Research Center, or NORC, at the University of Chicago, Nick was commissioned to write a monograph for the National Arts Endowment entitled Arts Education and Participation. And he recently completed a three-year national study, a path-breaking national study, entitled Teaching Artists and the Future of Education. His other publications include the influential co-edited volume Putting the Arts in the Picture, Reframing Education in the 21st Century. In his spare time, Nick blogs about the arts and arts education on the Huffington Post. Many of you will have seen his blogs there. And he's a member of a team that's working on a new cultural plan for the city of Chicago. I want to round out this introduction of Nick by quoting from a review of one of his publications. The tone is consistently intelligent, lively, and engaging. It's a joy to read as pure storytelling about kids and schools, teachers and artists, and educational injustice and sustained hope. It's also a pleasure to read for its strengths in policy analysis, for its willingness to grapple with intriguing and challenging intellectual puzzles concerning the role of aesthetic development in the cognitive growth of young people. Everyone who gives a damn should own a copy of this book. Read it and don't weep. Organize. I give you Nick Rabkin.
I want to know who said that. I liked it. I really did. Yeah, Chris said it. Thank you. Thank you all for coming here. I know in Los Angeles, I guess it's a long way to come here. So I very much appreciate it. I know I came probably farther than you, but I do appreciate it. So thanks for coming. This is a welcome opportunity for me to speak with members of the arts education community and the education community here in Los Angeles after doing this study in a dozen communities around the country. LA was one of our 12 study sites. I'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment. Can we cue the short video? As they cue this short video, which I'll introduce, will introduce my remarks, I just want to explain. There's a wonderful organization in Chicago called the Three Arts that gives awards to artists in three, to minority and women artists in three art forms, in the visual arts, theater, and dance. And 2 years ago, they began to give awards for the first time to teaching artists. It was a big deal. The video you're about to see is a very short piece that they prepared on the occasion of the first awards for a terrific, gifted teaching artist named Jessica Hudson. And Jessica was one of the artists who was invited to make some remarks at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, where the event, the awards event took place. And she began by asking the people in the audience at the MCA, how many of you know what a teaching artist is? The place was packed. It was a hall about this size, and everybody there goes to an art museum, is involved in the arts, cares about arts education in, on some level. Maybe a quarter raised their hands. So let me just say, how many of you know what a teaching artist is here? Okay, LA is better than Chicago, right? All right. Okay, can we cue the video? Here's Jessica Hudson.
I'm a theater maker and a teaching artist. Teaching artistry feeds me. It feeds my work, and this is my focus right now, and this is my 10th year doing teaching artist work. And I'm so interested in that feeding, that cyclical nature of teaching artist work and my artist work. They're both called work. The work I do to make money, the work I do to make my art, and yet they have to feed each other, and there's so much room for that. I think that we need to, I need to tap into that personally, and we as a field need to tap into that more, that place for putting your own work into the classroom. This idea of flight is fascinating to me. The word, of course, can go many ways. It's the first project that I really explicitly put some content that I'm also researching in my own work. That notion of hope and engineering, and this idea of these people who are standing on the ground and looking up and thinking, I want to go there. I want to see the world from that point of view. And what better concept that's broad enough but specific enough, flight, to give to kids to work with? We designed wings, and we built choreography, and we made music, and then we took all of that and put it in front of the public. The kids were being witnessed in a really positive manner by friends and family, but also by total strangers. And for an elementary school age student, that is one of the most it's just one of the biggest gifts you can give them.
She is a gift. And that's actually all I need to say. Teaching artists are a gift. And so I'm happy to tell you a little bit this evening about, where's that going? I was relying on that. Telling you a little bit about what we learned over those 3 years that we spent studying teaching artists. I know there are a couple of friends of mine from Chicago who've recently moved to L.A., so I wonder if anybody else recognizes the artist in the middle of that photograph. No, Maria, you don't know Juan Carlos. Okay, all right. I was so surprised. The Hammer found this photograph of an artist from Chicago and put it into the flyer, and I thought, oh, I should use it too. Well, okay, here we go. There are two headlines in arts education today. The first is that after a century of steady growth, there has been a significant decline in the proportion of American children who have taken classes or lessons in the arts. In 1930, that's over here, less than 25% had taken any classes or lessons in the arts. By 1980, there you go, roughly 1980, it was somewhere around 60 to 63%. But by 2008, it had declined below 50% again. Yes, that's right. So by 1982, it was up to two-thirds, and by 1980, below 50% again. As it turns out, virtually the entire decline has been absorbed by low-income minority children. The line at the top of the graph here, that's white kids from 1982 to 2008. These two lines are African-American and Latino kids. The decline has also been mostly in music and visual arts, the two subjects that are principally taught in schools, which leads to the inescapable conclusion that the decline is primarily centered in urban districts with where low-income minority students are concentrated. There is virtually an arts desert in many of the schools that they attend. The second headline. Over the same three decades, substantial numbers of teaching artists have moved beyond the community venues where they've taught for more than a century and into schools. They've mitigated, but they haven't reversed the decline. The best programs have had remarkable successes, often in the arts desert, and some of the successes have been documented by a growing body of research. TAs teach in many of these programs, and they often design and they manage them as well. Their successes suggest that any strategy to reverse the broad decline in arts education must include teaching artists. My hometown, Chicago, has a rather special role in the history of teaching artists. The first TAs were hired to run arts programs at Chicago's Hull House, the country's first settlement. By 1914, there were 400 settlement houses across the nation, and as I believe, I probably don't have a complete count, there were at least three here in Los Angeles. There was Toberman and East Side Settlements, and there was a place called Brownson House, and I found that little picture online from a brochure from Brownson House, 1901. Most of the settlements built substantial arts programs, and they had enormous influence during the progressive era in many areas, including juvenile justice, which was a major issue for Jane Addams. I mention juvenile justice because Louis Armstrong, who you see on the right in this, is that it? Yes, on your right in this photograph. Louis Armstrong is posed there with the teaching artist who taught him cornet at the Home for Colored Waifs in New Orleans, where he was confined after a youthful indiscretion at the age of 11. Benny Goodman, on the other side of this slide, took his first clarinet lessons at Hull House in Chicago. So I want to be clear that the settlements have made enormous contributions to American culture in the broadest sense. But those great artists notwithstanding, developing professional talent was not the mission of the settlements. Their idea was that the arts were for everyone and that cultural authority was not in the sole possession of the nation's new high arts conservatories, museums, and symphonies that emerged beside the settlements in the late 19th century. At the settlements, the arts were for other purposes. They were tools for weaving the webs of social connection that built strong communities. They were for cultivating the personal confidence, agency, and voice required to participate in a democracy and contribute to the culture. They were for preserving the connections of people to their own histories and for imagining worlds better and more hopeful than the ones that they had left behind or struggled in now. Those principles and objectives demanded a different kind of pedagogy than the conservatories that were tied to patronage and cultural hierarchy. This isn't to say that the settlements were not serious about aesthetics. They were. But they were also serious about a critical exploration of the world. They celebrated traditions, and they wove the arts into daily life, cultivating imagination and appreciating all the world's culture. I love this picture because it's such a contrast from the standard picture of students at the School of the Art Institute just a couple of miles away at the same time in the studio wearing their smocks and doing drawings of classic sculpture. Here were kids doing plein air drawing in the alley behind Hull House. They were exploring their lived experience and their lived environment through the arts. TAs developed these pedagogical principles in their work at the settlements and in the many community institutions that have followed them. And those of you who are teaching artists probably have experience working in those institutions now in LA. There are lots of them. But they were slow to enter the schools. That began changing in the mid-1960s, and by the 70s, it was fairly common for arts organizations to send artists into schools in significant numbers to help students learn to make art, moving beyond what began as kind of exposure programs towards something more serious, engaging to students, and meaningful to schools. As TAs began applying the spirit of social purpose from the settlements in the schools, they developed a keener understanding of the ways the arts affect learning and improve schools, too. And by the 90s, James Catterall, who for many years did very important research on arts education here at UCLA and has joined us for the evening, by the 90s, James Catterall was showing that higher levels of arts ed correlate strongly with better grades, higher test scores, graduation rates, college attendance and graduation, college grades, civic engagement, and early career employment, and they lower the likelihood of dropping out, substance abuse, violent behavior, or arrest. And I skipped probably 25 other good things that they correlate strongly to. The correlations, as it turns out, are stronger for low-income kids than they are for wealthier kids. Now, this, to me, raises a profound mystery, because if the school's problems are largely that they're failing low-income kids, and the arts seem to actually turn something on for those kids, why is it that they've been systematically eroded in the schools, as you saw on that slide? There are three big reasons. First, this Reagan-era report launched the school reform movement in 1983. It argued that schools had lost their focus, lowered their standards, and that a, quote, rising tide of mediocrity substituted appetizers and desserts for entrees in the curriculum, implying that arts ed was not emotionally nutritious. A Nation at Risk has been the template for school reform ever since. It barely mentioned the arts, and we all know that they are widely considered superfluous and inessential, educational fluff or junk food. But why were the arts categorized like that? The classical concept of the mind, that conscious and rational thought is of a fundamentally different and higher order than feelings and sensations, misconceives the arts as emotional and expressive, but not cognitive and academic. Thing is that modern cognitive science has shown that model of the mind is just wrong. Thinking, feeling, and our senses are all functions of one integrated nervous system. Good science proves that people actually can't think in the absence of feeling and sensation. It also proves that most thought is unconscious. This emergent model of the mind suggests that art, which lives in the connections between thought, feeling, and sensation, and connects the unconscious to conscious awareness, is profoundly cognitive. Nonetheless, our ideas about learning and our models of and the ways schools are structured are rooted in the old model, what neuroscientist Antonio Damasio has called Descartes' error. That's him himself right there. He made a mistake. Second, by the late 1970s, the transformation of the American economy that has proven so destructive to our national prosperity, the steep decline in manufacturing, the export of jobs from the U.S., and the growth of the U.S. service economy, was already damaging the financial stability of school systems across the country. In 1975, New York City endured a fiscal crisis, and President Ford responded by saying, "We won't bail out New York," resulting in this legendary New York, Daily News headline. Bailouts, I guess, are still unpopular. Chicago laid off all of its art and music teachers in its elementary schools in 1978. This pattern has intensified and hopscotched the country ever since. It continues. You're enduring it again here in L.A. now. Third, the Reagan Revolution was based in large measure on a deep resentment of government, often fueled by a misguided belief that the only beneficiaries of government programs were corrupt politicians and the undeserving poor, usually people with somewhat darker complexions. Proposition 13 was passed here in California in 1978. I don't need to tell you folks about the damage it's done to public services here. But the tax rebellion is now a sustained principle of American politics across the country. You may have started it here, but we all own it now. Public education and the arts have been among the most prominent targets, so arts education is in double jeopardy. Even Democratic administrations that speak to the value of creativity in education and that tend to be ineffective advocates for arts education. These days, though, there seems to be a growing recognition that the conventional approaches to school reform are not meeting their objectives. And some of the leading advocates of school reform have concluded that it has run off the tracks. Diane Ravitch, an undersecretary of education in the first Bush presidency and an early architect of the policies that led to No Child Left Behind, has become one of its most outspoken critics and a promoter of arts education. As that recognition widens, perhaps more policymakers will open up to the power of the arts to motivate, promote social and emotional development, open pathways into other subjects and back into school for alienated students, and heightened achievement. Recognizing the failures of school reform may open the door to strategies for improving schools through the arts. We saw signs of this growing awareness across the country in our research. And there are actually serious efforts underway in almost all of our study sites, including here in LA, despite all of the momentum that seems to be moving against arts education these days. Movements in all of our study sites to expand and improve arts education. In Boston, the effort is actually co-chaired by the superintendent of schools. Highly unusual. TAs and the partnerships in which they work are key in all of those efforts. But the success of those efforts will depend in large part on TAs who are capable and eager to pitch in. Our research suggests that there are large numbers of artists with the inclination, the disposition, and the capacity to do just that. So let's take a look at what we learned about TAs themselves. These are the dozen study sites that we did the study in. I won't read them to you. There won't be a quiz. You don't need to memorize them, but you'll find yourself on that list. We surveyed 3,500 TAs and program managers in a dozen study sites. We interviewed 220 artists, program managers, teachers, principals, funders, and district administrators in the study sites. And a couple of the interviewers for LA are here tonight, I'm happy to say. And here's what we found. 2/3 are women. They're well-educated. Half have master's degrees, and most of them have degrees in an art form. This was actually a surprising finding. Average age, 45. Most of them have been doing this work for about a dozen years. Do the math, works out that they started in their early to mid-30s for the most part. There are, of course, younger teaching artists, but we found it interesting, and we did interview some people that we asked about this. Why did you wait? And the most common answer, we didn't put this in the report because we just didn't get it from enough people, but the most common answer we got was because we had to know who we were as artists first. Here's what they do. TAs are most often responsible for providing gateway experiences to learning in the arts, and they generally teach basic skills. They often speak, though, also about teaching the processes of the arts, not just how to make art, but how to think like an artist. Most of the training that TAs get is informal, though the arts training itself is formal and intensive. They mainly learn to teach by teaching. It's significant that they do not rate the professional development that they generally have received from the organizations that they work for particularly highly. And very few received any preparation to teach while in school, although so many arts graduates do end up spending at least a portion of their career teaching. We heard complaints that training was mostly about the logistics of programs, not about teaching and learning, and that little training is designed for veteran artists and teaching artists. We heard complaints that too much training encouraged conformation to the narrow standards and conventional school concerns about order and discipline that seem inconsistent with the freedom, flexibility, and complexity of serious arts practice to which TAs aspire. On the other hand, we did find very sophisticated new training and professional development initiatives emerging in several cities. More than half of TAs work for nonprofit organizations. They usually work at their employer's venue. They work at museums, for example, and they work at the museum. But they're also sent out to other venues. And most of those who are sent out are sent out to K-12 schools. In all, about half of teaching artists spend at least part of their working life as teaching artists in schools. Most are not employees. 3/4 are unsalaried. They work on contracts. And only 1/4 teach full-time. Most TAs work part-time and had nearly 3 different employers in the last year. Their average pay is about $40 an hour, and I might add that the rate here in L.A. is actually on the high end of the spectrum that we saw. It's about $48 an hour here in L.A. California is the land of extremes. The state had the low. Bakersfield, California, $23 an hour, and Santa Cruz, $49. But the mean was $40 an hour. The problem is that they don't get very many hours. Keep in mind that most TAs teach only about 5 hours a week. So their actual take home from their work as teaching artists is less than $10,000 a year. It's not an easy life. This is hard. It's hard to make a life when you put a lot of your time and energy into work that pays so poorly. And it's not like the 5 hours that they work is all the work that they do. They're often not paid for prep time. They're never given allowance for transportation or car fare, mileage, meals. Forget it. It doesn't happen. This is a tough life. And, of course, they all have income from other sources. Many of them have income, 3/4 have income from their work in the arts themselves. But others do other kinds of work as arts administrators or in other fields altogether. And as you can see, their personal income, those that work part-time, Their personal income is generally around $36,000, which is close, a little lower than the average for all artists in America. But still, they struggle to make that $36,000. More than one-fifth has no health insurance. That's higher than the national average, which, of course, includes lots of poor people who are the principal group that doesn't have health insurance, higher than the national average of 16%. Health insurance, in fact, is the single biggest reason that teaching artists consider leaving the field. They need it. We spoke with many TAs who are deeply discouraged about the low pay, the insecurity, and the lack of insurance. Jessica Hudson, the wonderful teaching artist who I opened the program with just a few minutes ago, responded to a talk on this same study that I gave in Chicago recently, and her voice cracked as she said how burned out she felt, how tired she was of making too little, paying far more than she could afford for health insurance, and receiving so little validation for her years of work. But then in her next breath, she told a story about two students who'd been giving her a very hard time and how they had suddenly turned around that week, started to do their work, committed to their work, contributed to their class, and utterly surprised their teacher. That's what she lives for. So there's this balance in her life. TAs like their work. It means a lot to them. That's the real reason that they stick with it. They appreciate the chance to make money, even a little bit, in a field that they love. And they're loyal to their employers. Most would take more work if it were available. They believe, and I think this is very significant, they believe that teaching makes them better artists. Many connect teaching to community and social change. Their roots in the settlement movement are pretty clear. They are mission-driven people. They're deeply committed to the arts as a vehicle for their personal and artistic development and to using the arts to build better schools, stronger young people, and a better society. Their tenacity and their dedication to this demanding and complex work is remarkable. The biggest threat to building and sustaining a solid cadre of TAs is the material struggle that they endure, low pay, lack of health care and job security, and the lack of recognition and validation. But, yes, this is true. That sums it up. But I think I wasn't keeping up with myself. What makes the work of TAs powerful and productive? Well, for years, the answer to that question that I most often responded with was, it's the arts, stupid. And the arts are, in fact, a part of the answer to that question. But I wanted to try to push a little bit beyond that simple answer and true answer in my research because there is considerable evidence that the single most important thing to kids succeeding in school are good teachers. Aside from their socioeconomic status, that's the biggest, most powerful predictor of their success in schools. The next most powerful predictor is the quality of their teaching, the teaching that they receive. So I was wondering, was there a way for us to determine whether teaching artists are good teachers? And so I looked carefully at the research on what good teaching looks like. And I want to tell you that I was kind of delighted and surprised by what I found. Because in the end, our working hypothesis was that TAs are probably bringing effective approaches, perspectives, and practices and strategies to their teaching. And if we looked at those approaches and strategies and practices and they matched up with what the literature on good teaching looked like, I think we'd have something new and different to say about teaching artists. First, I was very surprised and delighted to find that there's broad agreement among experts about what good teaching looks like. It's grounded in three fundamental principles. First, it's student-centered. It balances students' interests and what they already know with new and real challenges, choices, and responsibilities, and it features curriculum that students find relevant. Second, good teaching is cognitive. Learning is the consequence of thinking and working on compelling ideas and problems, making connections across the curriculum, and demonstrating and representing an understanding in a range of media, including the arts. And third, good teaching is social. Individual students build competencies and knowledge, but students do that better together than they do it alone. Good teaching involves building a community of learners that works and thinks together, challenges each other. It reflects on its work and supports and takes the risks necessary to learn good things. When that happens in classrooms, kids really thrive. Now, not every program or teaching artist that we talked to or that took our survey subscribes equally to these principles. But they are, in fact, very widely embraced and woven into many TAs' teaching practices, just as they are into the processes of making art. I think, you know, those of you who are artists will see your own processes in those three principles. And in fact, if anybody at the Hammer, for example, asked me what is good arts programming look like, it would also follow those three principles. It needs to be relevant to the audience. It has to be cognitive. It has to be interesting. It has to stimulate people's minds. And it has to be social. And I think arts organizations are discovering that those principles apply to what they do these days, too. Now, let's examine what teaching artists actually told us their practice was like. Engagement is job one for TAs in schools. They are not, remember, regular faculty. Most see students for less than an hour a week and for just a few weeks before moving on. They need to win students' commitment quickly, and they found that the best way to do that is to take students' interests and ideas seriously. TAs believe students come to school with perspectives on the world and life, aesthetic ideas and tastes and concerns and questions that stimulate their curiosity and their creativity, a combination that artists often call voice. Activating and developing them is the surest way to engagement. A focus on voice and engagement is the essence of what student-centered really means. Artists sustain engagement by creating a safe space in which students can take risks and have considerable freedom to make choices. Okay, there's voice. I'm not very good at this slide stuff, I think. But at least I haven't canceled out the slideshow for a while, right? Okay, let's try it again. Sadly, there is a legitimate concern about violence in schools. Actually, I should go back to that because this is still about voice. And there's also a prevailing theory that academic failure stems from a lack of discipline. So schools make discipline and order very high priorities. The result, though, is that the most important thing that students need to learn in too many schools is how to follow rules. The freedom and flexibility embedded in the idea of voice are not a comfortable fit with that kind of discipline. TAs, it turns out, have a somewhat different perspective and approach to order and discipline. They are keenly aware that good learning environments are orderly and well-managed, But many told us that good classroom management is a function of engaging students in work in which they develop their voices. Student self-regulation is actually a much more powerful strategy for classroom management than yelling and threats that are common in so many low-income schools. Meaning, that's another concept we heard a lot of from TAs. It signifies actually three things. One, something means to all of us, a word, a gesture, a fact, a thought, a color, a sound. It also is what that thing or idea means in a particular context, in the context of the artwork itself. And it's also about what it means to someone. Making a thing or experience meaningful is a fundamental goal of art making, and when TAs refer, as they often do, to making meaning, they're referring to putting knowledge to use to create something that matters, both intellectually and emotionally. Good teachers encourage their students to make great efforts to do that, TAs reach for high standards because their work has meaning for them and because they want it to have meaning for others as well. Art is all about making things, ideas, and time meaningful. TAs think about connections in both social and cognitive terms. They build connections between students by encouraging them to learn about and from one another, and by structuring collaborative projects. It's rare that they will begin to teach a class without an introductory warm-up that changes the cool, emotionally buttoned-down classroom environment that sometimes into something more relaxed, personal, and energized. They build connections among students and to teachers, and they build connections with other subjects. Subjects organize knowledge, but they're not how we learn. Learning involves the movement of the mind from domain to domain and from what we already know to new experience, to things we don't know. We're constantly trying to find analogies between new experience and things we've already experienced. We're looking for the similarities between them. TA's good curriculum is designed to pose compelling questions about big themes and then look at them through multiple lenses. It's a roadmap for the mind's movement. Its most intentional expression is in arts integration, which connects arts methods, ideas, and content with methods, ideas, and content in other subjects around compelling problems. I was actually very surprised that two-thirds of the TAs who responded to our survey said that arts integration was very important to their practice. We found evidence that the approach is widespread across the country and that there is very serious interest in its potential among many school leaders. We interviewed superintendents who said, you know, we're having a hard time sustaining the arts in our schools, but this arts integration stuff is really of interest to us. It's a hopeful sign. Well, in some respects, yeah? Let's talk about it just a bit, because I know there are plenty of folks out there, and probably some in this audience, who are really skeptical about arts integration, concerned that it trivializes art, makes it a handmaiden to other subjects, and dispenses with artistic rigor. Done poorly, I would say it is just about as trivial as the hand turkey art that is so commonplace at Thanksgiving in classrooms across the country. But it can also be extraordinary. Some TAs refer to the elegant fit between the processes of art making and learning in other subjects. Good integration has an aesthetic integrity. Luke Albrecht, an eighth grade math teacher at Crown Academy in the Englewood neighborhood of Chicago, one of our poorest neighborhoods, has worked with TAs for many years. My thanks to Luke for this. What do Monet's Wheatstacks paintings have to do with math? Anybody know? Yeah, actually, all of the above. That's right. That's right. But here's what he said that surprised me that I wouldn't have thought of either. He said, Monet painted light and color over time. His paintings are a data set. When you look at Monet's paintings and you organize them across the seasons and the times of day, you can begin to make predictions of what the haystacks might look like at other times and in other seasons. That is what math does, too. Math is about understanding patterns and making predictions. So there are actually rather deep connections between haystacks and math. Luke succeeded in interesting eighth graders at one of Chicago's lowest performing schools in high school algebra. This is unheard of at Crown Academy before he started to do this work. Finding those connections is a key to successful partnerships between TAs and classroom teachers. Viola Spolin, who is one of my personal Chicago heroes, some of you who here knows who Viola was? This is great. You know, you guys have the groundlings out here. And you know, so Viola lived in L.A. for some time. She worked out here for some time. She is a central figure in the history of teaching artists. She worked at Hull House in the 1930s and organized dozens of community theaters in parks during the Depression. She's the mother of theater games. Spolin understood that play and games are fundamental to learning. She understood that imaginative play is the root of theater, and that the impulse to make theater is in everyone. Spolin wrote, quote, "Games worth playing are highly social and have a problem that needs solving in them. Each individual must become involved with others while attempting to reach a goal." It sounds like the literature on good teaching, doesn't it? But it hadn't been written yet. Incidentally, just for those of you who don't know who Viola was, Viola did this work at Hull House, ended up writing books about theater games that have become classic texts for theater instruction across the country. Her son, Paul Sills, was one of the co-founders of the Second City. And he took his mother's theater games and he applied them. Second City, as you know, sort of transformed comedy across America, but every theater artist in Chicago at some point was trained in theater games. Viola, the reason that Chicago's a great theater town in large part has to do with an environment that Viola shaped with these theater games. So again, enormously important educationally, but also an enormous contribution to American culture. Huffington Post recently published a piece that I wrote about teaching artists and good teaching, and one commentator took me to task for failing to praise the arts standards or to note that full-time faculty are an endangered species in many schools. So I want to take a moment to do that now. In fact, I would argue that the most effective programs that we saw in schools make a conscious effort to connect and engage arts faculty, often the most marginalized parts of the faculty in schools, and bring them to the center of what the school is about. When teaching artists and arts specialists collaborate, the potential to really transform schools is dramatically multiplied. I don't think that either can do that without the other. But I think it's a mistake, as some believe, to think that teaching artists are a fundamental cause of the erosion of arts faculty in schools. Arts education is endangered by the ideology of school reform, by right-wing attacks on public education, and by the fiscal crisis of government in America, not by teaching artists. No one is arguing that arts education can be salvaged by outsourcing it to less expensive part-time teaching artists. And we saw no evidence that policymakers believe that that is what should happen. TAs are equally endangered by the decline of arts ed in schools. What happened first in LA, what, a year and a half, 2 years ago? What was the huge program of partnerships between arts organizations and schools? That was the first thing that was cut. It was TAs that got it first. So TAs and arts faculty are in the same boat in the final analysis. As for the arts standards, I have a little bit more ambivalence, to be perfectly candid. We didn't speak to a soul who dismissed them. But they were roundly criticized, not just by artists, as it turns out, but also by classroom teachers, principals, and school administrators. They had a bifurcated view of what the problem was complex view of what the problem was with the standards. On the one hand, they thought that they were too encyclopedic to be practical. There's just too much material to cover. And there's no sense of what matters most. What are the priorities? What really matters? What are the things that actually, in the standards, would contribute to the best possible outcomes in classrooms? At the same time, they think of the standards as insufficiently aspirational. Because they're focused almost exclusively on technical skills and formal knowledge of the disciplines. TAs worry that the standards ignore what they think of as higher standards. Thinking like an artist, making good judgments, learning from mistakes, taking risks, making connections, and always seeing the world from multiple perspectives. These are actually all sort of higher order thinking strategies. They're not just arts strategies, but they're built into the practice of making art. One TA told me, knowing the formal structure of a haiku or a sonnet does not make a good poem. I want my students to write good poems. Okay, let's draw this to a conclusion. Where do we stand? What did we learn from the research that really matters? A few key findings. After 3 decades of decline and in the midst of major financial challenges, this may be an important turning point for arts education. Frankly, I'm afraid that arts education will keep withering in the schools if policymakers don't rethink the strategies that have dominated school reform. But there are signs that that may be beginning to happen, and if they do, arts education could become a focus of bold new efforts to engage students, deepen learning, and enliven school cultures. Last year, Education Secretary Arne Duncan, my homeboy, right, wrote, "Education in the arts is more important than ever. In the global economy, creativity is essential. The best way to foster that creativity is through arts education." The pendulum that swung far away from the arts during these last 3 decades of school reform may swing back if values like creativity and innovation are more broadly embraced as essential purposes of education and schools. But I'd like to see my homie turn that talk to walk. Change, though, I remind myself constantly, is evolutionary. So talk first, but let's keep pressing the boy to make the walk. 2, I won't repeat this ad nauseum, but TA's teaching strategies are aligned with what experts see as the principles of good teaching and learning. 3, the assets that TAs bring to schools make schools less like school and more like studios and rehearsal halls. And 4, TAs are an abundant but underdeveloped resource. There are far more college graduates with arts degrees than opportunities or jobs for artists, per se. So most are already developing hybrid careers. Many are developing hybrid careers in education, and many more would if there were more opportunities. What are the policy implications of these findings? First, build demand for the arts. Creative advocacy should be based on rigorous research, and it should tell powerful stories about student learning and development, particularly about students, about the arts and students who have real difficulty in schools. And actually, stories matter, and TAs are great sources of stories. So those of you who are in management, collect them from your TAs. Make the field sustainable. Advocates for arts education should also advocate and attend to material conditions for artists, for teaching artists. Systematic improvements are very tough in this economy, but even symbolic validation will help. And I have to say, healthcare reform will too. Third, develop arts integration. Arts integration has not received the systematic support that disciplinary or standards-based arts education received from the late 1980s, and it should get it now. 4, the arts standards are a sequential ladder of knowledge and skills. They were developed to inhibit the erosion of faculty positions in the arts and their replacement by teaching artists. They actually haven't worked very well for either purpose. Schools need full-time arts faculty and they need TAs. We can't expand arts education without the development of TAs as a basic resource. Distinct roles for specialists and for TAs can be developed by analyzing their work in schools where they're working successfully now. There are models out there, but nobody's really looked carefully at them. We should take a look at them. And so I would urge you to identify schools in Los Angeles now where there are TAs and arts faculty working well together and learn from those schools. That's the only way we're going to resolve the conflict between TAs and arts specialists. Reflective practice and formative assessment are key processes in the cycle of art making, and both are badly needed in schools where students are trained to be fearful of mistakes and where multiple choice tests distort the curriculum and learning. Assessment can be the area of the next big contribution of TAs to schools. Make it a priority. But don't conform to the conventional traps of test-based assessment. Professional development for TAs should be centered on the practice and experience of the work, built on an understanding of TAs of the relationship between the arts and learning, filled with hands-on project-based experiences that develop real community among TAs and teachers. Hints for those of you who are developing such programs in your arts organizations or at your colleges and universities. And finally, sustain and grow non-school community-based arts education. These days, so much of the practice that TAs have brought into schools was first developed outside schools, in those rehearsal halls and studios, in community settings of all kinds, from jails to churches and parks to storefronts. We need that laboratory still. Teaching artists into schools without sustaining that laboratory is insufficient. The culture of schools in America is so difficult that without that robust energy and creativity that comes from those outside sources, I would actually say what goes on in schools will also decline over time. These days, we often feel like we're kind of cleaning the Augean stables, those of us who are in arts education. But I encourage you to remember that if nothing else, artists are resourceful folks. They spin gold from straw. And it will take persistence and great imagination to create a better future for arts education and for teaching artists. It's true. But if artists have anything in abundance, they have imagination and persistence. For now, that's all I want to say. But I want to introduce you to an old friend of mine, Merrill Friedman, who now left Chicago, silly girl, to move to Los Angeles and works at UCLA, is going to kind of take over this portion of the program. So let me introduce you to Merrill, who will explain more.
You did good. Hi, everybody. I'm Merrill Friedman, and is this too loud? Am I okay? Yes? I'm the Director of Education and Community Programs, very long title, at the newly named Center for the Art of Performance at UCLA, formerly UCLA Live. And Chris and Barbara asked me to come and lead the Q&A festivities this evening, because not only do I engage in art-making activities on campus and in the community, but I'm also a teaching artist. And I've been one in Chicago, where Nick and I first met each other and have planned and plotted and schemed together for many years, and also here in Los Angeles, grand total of about 20 years. And I'm embarrassed to say that I totally and completely fit that profile. Of people who are teaching artists, women over 45. No formal training until they started to do it, on and on and on. One of the many programs that I run at CAP UCLA and through UCLA is a really wonderful program called Design for Sharing, which is actually a 40-year-old program that was started by a couple of wonderful women who were not teaching artists but believed passionately in the arts and thought that everybody, no matter what color and income level, should have access to them on a great and wonderful research university. And one of the many programs that Design for Sharing does is run a teaching artist residency that I think your words were, manage and design, which I do along with three wonderful teaching artist colleagues at the UCLA Community School. And we work with 200 fourth, fifth, and sixth graders every week, twice a week, teaching them dance, creative writing, and theater. And I am here to attest that you have never really, truly experienced salsa until you've danced it with a fourth grade boy. And I encourage all of you to do that before you're dead, because it's great. So what we're going to do, actually, for the Q&A portion, and you guys will excuse me if I... Yeah. What we're going to do for the Q&A portion before we kind of open it up and talk to everybody is that we've actually invited two of my colleagues here tonight, two really wonderful teaching artists who have been teaching here in Los Angeles for a long time. And in the interest of time, I'm actually not going to read your wonderful bios, but I will say just a short little thing about each of them. Ana Maria Alvarez is the founding artistic director of Contratiempo, Latin Urban Dance Theater here in Los Angeles, and a colleague of mine who I have taught with for the past 3 years. She's won numerous awards and grants and commissions. Contratiempo performs throughout the United States and currently is in residence in over 25 schools in Los Angeles. And they not only talk the talk, but they walk the walk every day. And Ana Maria is here. And my friend Cheryl Walker is also here. Cheryl is a visual artist extraordinaire. She participates in events and exhibitions, public and private, throughout the world. Her work is held in private collections in Europe and in Los Angeles. She's been an educator and an artist for over 20 years. I've worked with them both, and I'm absolutely delighted that they're here with us to share some of their thoughts. Give them a big welcome, and come on up and join us. So do you guys have things that you're burning to say, or should I start with something?
Go ahead. Work it out.
Okay. So one of the things that really resonated with me, Nick, about the presentation tonight and just hearing you say it live and also hearing all of you guys ooh and ah and respond and sigh and moan and connect with that, because we were all doing a lot of that, is this notion about how being a teaching artist makes you a better artist. And I would advocate that actually being a teaching artist makes you a better person, which makes you a better artist. Mm-hmm. And so I want both of you to talk a little bit about that, and how do you also find the balance between your own practice, finding the time for your own work in a really hostile and unfriendly environment, and the classroom demands? How do you do it? What makes you do it? Why do you like to do it?
I can go. Do you want me to?
Go ahead.
Okay. So the work that we do in Contratiempo is, I mean, it wouldn't exist without the arts education component of what we do. Our work is very much about, I mean, our mission is to bring to life voices on the concert stage that are not traditionally heard in that space. And I think that by being in the classroom, specifically in a lot of the underserved schools that we work with all over LA, we are, by relating and connecting and dancing salsa with fourth graders and you know, having the experiences and the conversations and asking the questions and hearing their responses that always blow our mind. I think she said it really beautifully. It feeds you as an artist in a way that I think, you know, being in a rehearsal space or in a studio by yourself creating movement work or creating choreography or creating theater work that's sort of disconnected from that on the ground, what's going on in the world, is not what we're committed to and not what we're interested in. I also think when you are in the classroom, you really have no choice. It's like this, you know, we talk about it in our company all the time, is like getting out of your own way. When you are recreating the experience of understanding dance and understanding choreography and understanding the power of when people work together and communicate and connect and empathetically relate to one another, we teach a lot of partner dancing in what we do. When you are experiencing that by sharing that with someone, it reminds you and sort of reteaches you what you care about and what's important to you. So I feel like a lot of times this idea of, and I know that might sound like cheesy, but it's like sharing and giving of yourself doesn't allow you to get caught up in, like you talked about, the hostile environment. I mean, it's like you don't have time for that. You don't have time to be sitting around thinking about how hostile the environment it is, because you have a kid that if you're not present with them right now, they're going to derail the entire classroom and all hell is going to break loose. So it's like that sort of keeping yourself present in a way, I feel like, is really crucial as an artist. And I think that sometimes as artists who are not, don't have the opportunity to do this, I think they get into their own heads and get into all this kind of getting caught up in the environment we live in. And yeah, I feel like that's a real blessing of being a teaching artist and teaching as many kids as we do is that we're in it, and like in a way that doesn't allow us to get caught up in the BS of the world we live in. Towards our, sure. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah.
Do you want to say something? For me, I don't think my art practice could exist without my teaching practice, and to even hear myself say that is pretty significant. It's been a real gradual development. I'm definitely not the kind of artist that sits in my studio by myself and makes art. And once in a while, when I do have the opportunity to do that, it has so much more meaning. Art is a dialogue. It's not about sitting there making a picture. It's about us communicating with each other in a creative way. And my favorite thing to do is to collaborate. And the projects I've worked on with Merrill and with interdisciplinary artists have then fed my own practice so that it has become more interdisciplinary. I've never done one thing. My work is always about making connections between disciplines, establishing a context for the art to exist. Even if you are making a thing, it has to exist in a context and communicate. And more and more, I'm enjoying working with movers and thinkers and people who work in disciplines other than my own. But I really do believe it's about the connections and working interdisciplinarily that will lead to the future, not just thinking about making art in boxes. I think it's our job to break down the boundaries of those boxes.
Yeah. Can I say something else? Something also that's really interesting, I feel like, in this practice of being a teaching artist, but also being whether it's a performance artist or a visual artist, where you're creating your own work and you're actually presenting your own work in a professional way, I think what's really interesting is that what you learn from the students and what they contribute to your own thinking about your work actually reflects what you create work about, and then mm-hmm. when you then mm-hmm. you are completely inspired to create work in a different way, and then as you create that work, performing it and sharing it with the students, they then it's almost like they see a different level of their own thinking through your interpretation of their thinking. And so I think it's, you know, you hear people all the time saying that arts in schools really creates a higher level of thinking. But I think that relationship and that dialogue between young people really impacting what's happening with professional artists, and professional artists then therefore kind of sharing with students what they're getting from them, I think allows students to realize that they have really incredible and important ideas, and the ways that they're looking at the world are really imaginative and are progressive. And
yeah. Can you here's the researcher in me.
Yeah.
Can you give me give the crowd
yeah.
an example?
Absolutely.
Of something yeah. that you did in your work as a professional artist who leads a dance company
mm-hmm.
That you might not have done if you hadn't done some work in
totally. Yeah, I mean the example I was actually thinking about when I was saying it, I and I'll try to say it in as short a way possible. But I worked with a sixth grade a class on poetry and movement, and we were working with Langston Hughes's poetry, and I asked my students to write a poem that was based on Dream Deferred and also Let America Be, but taking golden lines from the poem and creating their own work around that. And then we created an entire movement piece that really was about their responses to this poem. One of my students, who was, you know, really very shy and kind of not necessarily the biggest, you know, biggest leader or participator in the class at all, she wrote this incredible piece that was taking the words of Langston Hughes, putting it in the voice of her mother, crossing the border into Guatemala, and she all of a sudden, this 12-year-old in the span of like a page, juxtaposed the African American Latino experience and brought these connections that, you know, people. I mean, we go to high schools where people were like sitting on different parts of the cafeteria and fighting after school because of this idea that these two communities are at each other's throats or pitting one another against each other. And this 12-year-old in her poem, created this incredible connection of the shared struggles between these two communities. We were so inspired. I mean, the teachers, we were all like, ah, you know, crying afterwards. We were reading her poem afterwards. And I got completely inspired to create a work about something that I had seen in all the schools that we'd been working with, which was this tension between African-American and Latino students, but also using her poem, which was completely imaginative and beautiful and moving, as the central poem for this piece. So I asked her mother and I asked her, would they mind if we used her words for this performance piece? And so we wound up creating an entire evening work called I Dream America that was her poem was the first thing that the audience hears. It's actually part of her poem is the first thing the audience hears, and then the rest of her poem is the last thing that the audience hears. And she wound up debuting the piece with us and being on stage with us during the very last piece, part. And we've toured that piece all over the country for the last 3 or 4 years. And then she's a teenager now, and she, you know, has come back and visited our programs, and, you know, I'm still in touch with her and her mother. And I mean, she considers herself a poet. And I honestly don't know if she would have thought of herself as a poet without having the experience of seeing her work. I'm going to get like moved, but like seeing her work on, you know, taken that seriously. And it was incredible work and it was beautiful. And it wouldn't, us as a professional company wouldn't be doing the work we're doing if it wasn't for her work. So yeah, I hope that's
great.
I know that you guys are dying to participate and you probably have questions. Before we open up, I just want to ask you guys, was there anything that really surprised you or challenged you from the research that you want to share?
I think the access in low-income communities cannot be emphasized enough. One of my four gigs is teaching at the vocational campus at Long Beach City College. And in my 23 years of teaching, I have never witnessed a class that is so ill-prepared for college in my entire life. I teach drawing, and I really try to create that safe environment for risk-taking to occur. I think that parallels the risk-taking in my life in this profession. I'm a collaborator and a risk taker by nature, and I try to create that in the classroom as well. But these kids need acknowledgement and have wonderful ideas, and I try to get them to think bigger because they haven't been encouraged to think bigger than their next job. Mm. And it's all about getting a job and what can I do, and I'm going to miss class because I need to, they're going to pay me to be, you know, over at this other, for these 3 hours. And they think short term and not long term. So that is my personal, I really would like to see an emergency reenactment of the WPA immediately, and I think we need to do it. It was artists who went to Eleanor Roosevelt, and we need to do it, and all the people in this room together with all your networks and all of it. It's an emergency.
Clearly was an important thing, and it was struck me, and I see it every day, but definitely made a difference. I feel like what frustrates me the most is that, I mean, the $40 being what the teaching artists are, I mean, I'm happy to say we pay our teaching artists way more than that, but we also, I'm so frustrated right now about having what we, if you look at our company from the outside, you'd think we are actually a very, you know, we're within the state of not having any funding governmentally. We're raising money from individual donors, and we're continuing to like work with partners like you guys and still being able to provide arts program. But our artists do not have health care. One of my dancers is injured right now, and, you know, we're trying to raise money for him to get an MRI. I mean, it's insane. It's like complete insanity that people are working so hard. They are so dedicated. They're so incredible at what they do and such important parts of these young people's lives, and that they are really treated like nothing. And I think that's what, seeing all those statistics in that way is just, it is demoralizing. I mean, as a teaching artist. And then at the same time, you know, when you said right after, that her voice cracked, but at the, you know, right after she talked about two students that were the ones that, you know, came around finally, it's like, you laugh, but you know that is what keeps you coming back. And so I guess there's nothing in me that is like, oh, I'm not going to do this because it's not paying me enough money. But it's more, I have a lot of fire underneath me that I'm really committed to running a company where we're paying our artists competitively and that we can provide healthcare, because I just think it's a fundamental human right. And it's so crazy that there's so many people in our world that don't have, I mean, so many people in our country that don't have it. So, yeah.
Anybody have something they want to say? Anything that they want to ask?
Please. We have two microphones that are roaming the aisles here, so if you see your hand up, we'll come down and bring the mic to you.
House right.
Oh, wow.
Can first. You tell us who you are?
Bond, James Bond.
Great.
Steve Vence. I'm the principal at Quincy Jones Elementary School.
Oh, excellent.
And I have a question for Nick. And before I ask the question, I just want to put it in perspective, because it could just sound like we're looking for more money for arts education, but it's really a broader issue, and the question has to do with what's happening in Chicago and other places where you've done your research. And that is, it comes down to equity, and it's coming down to access. So where this art school is, it's down in South LA. We have, you know, shootings, and for example, I saw the screen, and I thought first, it just reminded me of a scene that I'd seen recently. I thought the kids were touching a casket instead of a car. So it's a very highly impacted community. And so what I'm bringing up is, if you look through Los Angeles, you go to schools where you have families that are high income, middle income, they can raise the monies for arts education. But what's happened here in Los Angeles in particular, and what's happened across California in particular, is that the money that's coming to education is coming, really the main money is coming through categorical funds. That's Title I, Title II, Title III, addressing the equity issue and addressing real education. It's a lot of money. Some of that money is being wasted. If you look at school budgets, and you know, you were talking about like $40 a teaching artist, if you would see how much money is truly wasted through categorical funds, you would get nauseous. So what's happening now is that we're unable to use these monies to provide arts education, to really build community within the school. Like if you, for example, Father Boyle, if you know of Homeboy mm-hmm. Industries. Mm-hmm. The essence of his organization is about kinship. And you think about arts education, and we talk about the, you know, the standards and the rigor, but some of the things we don't talk about is that kinship that's building upon that. So now my question to you is, with this changing of No Child Left Behind, some things that we have to really push for a little more than what we're doing now, is that what have you seen across other states in terms of releasing Title I, Title II, Title III funds for teaching artists and even teachers who have a credential? Because it's not about either or, as you were saying.
I don't think that LA is an exception by any stretch of the imagination. I think what you just described is happening virtually every place. It's certainly what's been happening in Chicago, too. There's very little Title I, II, or III money that gets directed toward the arts at all. Most of the work that's going on in the schools has been privately funded by foundations. A little bit, Chicago's been lucky. I know that LA has been lucky too. There have been a few fairly substantial grants from the Department of Education for arts education here and in Chicago. But they're rare. There's not very much money. I think, what, $16 million a year came from the Department of Education for arts education.
Which is grants. Nothing.
Yeah, it's nothing for the whole country. So there's really, where it's happening because people are taking initiative and hustling. And I had a conversation with someone at lunch about this equity issue, and I have to say I'm very conflicted about this is a strategic question in a certain sense. One of the reasons I think that arts education is not funded is because people basically don't believe it's valuable. The people who make decisions about schools don't believe it's valuable. So one of our tasks is to prove that it's valuable. In Chicago, the average school has less than one FTE art or music teacher. Less than one, okay? In a school with 750 students, less than one art or music teacher, you don't get both. You get, you know, if you're less than 750 students, you get 0.5 FTE in one or the other subject. Is that enough to make a difference? Does it matter if Chicago Public Schools were equitable in the distribution of that much arts education? I don't think we actually know the answer to that, but I suspect the answer is no. It won't matter. That there has to be more. That there needs to be a critical mass of this before it matters. And so sometimes I think to myself, boy, equity is an issue. There's no question. Those graphs showed it. It's black and brown kids that are getting shafted. No question. On the other hand, if we insist that the little bit of resources that are going to arts education now get distributed equitably across the schools, nobody's going to get enough. So it might be wise, here's a strategic thought, to say, okay, some of you probably know that the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities recently made a proposal that they're going to raise money so that 6 to 8 schools, model schools, are going to be turned into sort of fabulous centers for arts education and demonstrate the power of the arts. 6 to 8 across the country. I've had a similar thought, though. You know, what if there were 6 to 8 or 10 in Chicago and 10 in L.A. and 20 in New York and 5 in Boston? That might be enough. You know, I don't think 6 to 8 schools across the country is going to turn the tide. I don't think it's going to prove to enough people, because people have to see this to believe it. You have to hear people like this talk about their experiences, and you have to see the kids work, too. That's when you really start to believe it. So until there's a critical mass, I don't think it'll happen. And I just don't think that, you know, thinking only about equity is gonna do the trick. I think we actually do have to build critical mass in enough schools in places like L.A. So that enough people see it. Because they won't believe it until they see it. I don't think... All of James's research has been enormously important on sort of making the idea of arts education legitimate, but it hasn't turned the tide. People have to see it. The data alone don't do the trick.
Is there somebody else with a microphone that was next? No? Is there? Yep.
Were you going to call on someone? I'm sorry.
I thought had you given the microphone to somebody?
No, I hadn't.
No, there's somebody right there.
My name is Liz Flores, and I'm not a TA. I'm a general studies teacher, and I wanted to tie in my experience working at religious schools. I'm a Catholic, and I'm working at an Orthodox Jewish school, and I happen to have all fifth-grade boys, which is my dream come true. And I just turned 50, and I can kick, so that combination is really good. I have my credential. I loved your Langston Hughes story. Forget about it. That was awesome. But the beauty of my experience is that UCLA, I studied dance. And so I'm incorporating movement in the limited Orthodox way that I can, while fully covered, of course. But the response from these boys is unbelievable. So yes, we address low-income students. Yes, we address students of color. Yes, we address students, the handicapable students that are handicapable, excuse me. But I also want to bring in, I guess, a gender bias as well, that you can move and learn and rap. They're rapping to Langston Hughes. It's great. I was playing Miles Davis for them. Now, if the rabbi comes in, I could be in huge trouble, but I wanted to, first of all, commend you. I'm on Medi-Cal. I was diagnosed with cancer. Medi-Cal, thank God, paid for all my treatment. But I hear you. You can do it. I don't even focus on the negative. I focus on what I have and how incredible those kids are. So thank you.
Thanks. I actually, in thinking a little bit about this today, it occurred to me, actually last night at 4 o'clock in the morning, that the voice that was missing from this forum today actually is the voice of our students. So I actually wanted to bring in a poem from one of our students, and you can see that there's lots of kind of fun drawings on this. But this is from one of our, she's now sixth grade. We started working with her at community school. She came late into the term as a fourth grader. Her family immigrated from Bangladesh. When she first came to us, she spoke three languages, none of them English, and was very shy about participating in all of the ways that you might imagine. And at the end of the second year, she actually handed me this poem on what was our last day with them. And the kids know from year to year that we don't know at the end of the year whether or not we'll be able to raise the funds to come back. This is a very prevalent, real thing for them. And we can't say at the end of the year, oh, we'll see you next year, because we don't know that we'll have the money. So this was a poem that she had written. And keep in mind that she'd only been speaking English for about 8 months when she wrote this poem. So the poem is called If You Forget. She says, and her name is Actor, and this is what she says. She says, I want you to know how this is. If I look at the movement, if I touch near my heart, the thoughts I have or the ideas I have, everyone carries to you, my teachers, as if everything is dark and it's now clear. Well now, if little by little you stop teaching me, I shall stop learning little by little. If suddenly I did mistake and did not stop, you say, keep it, for I shall keep learning. If you think it's good or bad that passes through my life, and you decide, well, are you going to come back or not? Remember that on this day, at this hour, I shall move arms, and my roots will set off to seek another land. But each day, each hour, I dance, and I sing, and I write, and I say thank you to my teachers. That's why we do it. I had someone once, not too many weeks ago, say to me, so that thing that you do at community school, like 2 or 3 days a week, how much longer are you going to do that? And I said, well, as long as I can. So get active. Thank you all for coming. Network, discuss, let us know where you're from so that we kind of know how the word got out. We're really interested to know who you are and how you heard about what we do. Does everybody know how to get Nick if you need him? Yeah? Do you want?
I hope nobody wants to get
Nick. Nobody wants to get him. He wants to interact with Nick if you need him. We'll tell you. Come up. Talk to us.
Copy of your talk. It's going to be
posted. Yes. The whole thing is going to be posted on...
The whole thing is going to be on something called UCTV broadcast online. And if you Google it, we don't have the link yet, but if you Google it, UCTV Nick Rabkin Hammer Museum, you will know. And I have my card here. I can pass them out to you if you want. We can get you in contact. We'll make sure that you all get it. Thank you all so much for coming. And it's also on the Hammer website. Thank you. Great. Hammer website and at iTunes. Thank you, everybody, so much for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.